Greece, in the Roman Empire, or in medieval Europe, would have found the idea familiar and highly attractive. 20 challengers go in, only one hero comes out. Wonderful! A Homeric prince, a Roman patrician, or a Crusader knight would have thought to himself, as he sat down to watch. Surely we are about to see amazing adventures, life and death battles, and incomparable acts of heroism and betrayal. The warriors will probably stab each other in the back or spill their entrails for all to see. What a disappointment. The backstabbing and entrail spilling remain just a metaphor. Each episode lasts about an hour. Out of that, 15 minutes are taken up by commercials for toothpaste, shampoo, and cereals. 5 minutes are dedicated to incredibly childish challenges, such as who can throw the most coconuts into a hoop, or who can eat the largest number of bugs in 1 minute. The rest of the time, the heroes just talk about their feelings. He said, she said, and I felt this and I felt that. If a Crusader knight had really sat down to watch Survivor, he would probably have grabbed his battle axe and smashed the TV out of boredom and frustration. Today we might think of medieval knights as insensitive brutes. If they lived among us, we would send them to a therapist who might help them get in touch with themselves. This is what the Tin Man does in The Wizard of Oz. He walks along the yellow brick road with Dorothy and her friends, hoping that when they get to Oz, the great wizard will give him a heart, while the scarecrow wants a brain and the lion wants courage. At the end of their journey, they discover that the great wizard is a charlatan, and he can't give them any of these things. But they discover something far more important. Everything they wish for is already within themselves. There is no need of some godlike wizard in order to obtain sensitivity, wisdom, or bravery. You just need to follow the yellow brick road and open yourself to whatever experiences come your way. Exactly the same lesson is learned by Captain Kirk and Captain Jean-Luc Picard as they travel the galaxy in the starship Enterprise, by Huckleberry Finn and Jim as they sail down the Mississippi, by Wyatt and Billy as they ride their Harley-Davidsons in Easy Rider, and by countless other characters in myriad other road movies who leave their hometown in Pennsylvania, or perhaps New South Wales, travel in an old convertible, or perhaps a bus, pass through various life-changing experiences, get in touch with themselves, talk about their feelings, and eventually reach San Francisco, or perhaps Alice Springs, as better and wiser individuals. The truth about war. The formula, knowledge equals experiences times sensitivity, has changed not just our popular culture, but even our perception of weighty issues like war. Throughout most of history, when people wished to know whether a particular war was just, they asked God, they asked scriptures, and they asked kings, noblemen, and priests. Few cared about the opinions and experiences of a common soldier or an ordinary civilian. War narratives, such as those of Homer, Virgil, and Shakespeare, focused on the actions of emperors, generals, and outstanding heroes, and though they did not hide the misery of war, this was more than compensated for by a full menu of glory and heroism. Ordinary soldiers appeared as either piles of bodies slaughtered by some Goliath, or a cheering crowd hoisting a triumphant David upon its shoulders. Look, for example, at the painting of the Battle of Breitenfeld, which took place on the 17th of September, 1631. The painter, Jean-Jacques Walter, glorifies King Gustav Adolf of Sweden, who led his army that day to a decisive victory. Gustav Adolf towers over the battlefield as if he were some god of war. One gets the impression that the king controls the battle like a chess player moving pawns. The pawns themselves are mostly generic figures, or tiny dots in the background. Walter was not interested in how they felt while they charged, fled, killed, or died. They are a faceless collective. Even when painters focused on the battle itself, rather than on the commander, they still looked at it from above, and were far more concerned with collective manoeuvres than with personal feelings. Take, for example, Peter Snares's painting of the Battle of White Mountain in November 1620. The painting depicts a celebrated Catholic victory in the 30 Years' War over heretical Protestant rebels. Snaeus wished to commemorate this victory by painstakingly recording the various formations, manoeuvres and troop movements. You can easily tell the different units, their armament and their place within the order of battle. Snaeus gave far less attention to the experiences and feelings of the common soldiers. Like Jean-Jacques Walter, he makes us observe the battle from the Olympian vantage point of gods and kings, and gives us the impression that war is a giant chess game. If you take a closer look, for which you might need a magnifying glass, you realize that the Battle of White Mountain is a bit more complex than a chess game. What at first sight seem to be geometrical abstractions turn upon closer inspection into bloody scenes of carnage. Here and there you can even spot the faces of individual soldiers running or fleeing, firing their guns or impaling an enemy on their pikes. However, these scenes receive their meaning from their place within the overall picture. When we see a cannonball smashing a soldier to bits, we understand it as part of the great Catholic victory. If the soldier is fighting on the Protestant side, his death is a just reward for rebellion and heresy. If the soldier is fighting in the Catholic army, his death is a noble sacrifice for a worthy cause. If we look up, we can see angels hovering high above the battlefield. They are holding a billboard which explains in Latin what happened in this battle and why it was so important. The message is that God helped Emperor Ferdinand II defeat his enemies on the 8th of November, 1620. For thousands of years, when people looked at war, they saw gods, emperors, generals, and great heroes. But over the last two centuries, the kings and generals have been increasingly pushed to the side, and the limelight shifted onto the common soldier and his experiences. War novels, such as All Quiet on the Western Front, and war films, such as Platoon, begin with a young and naive recruit, who knows little about himself and the world, but carries a heavy burden of hopes and illusions. He believes that war is glorious, our cause is just, and the general is a genius. A few weeks of real war, of mud and blood and the smell of death, shatter his illusions one after another. If he survives, the naive recruit will leave war as a much wiser man, who no longer believes the clichés and ideals peddled by teachers, filmmakers, and eloquent politicians. Paradoxically, this narrative has become so influential that today it is told over and over again, even by teachers, filmmakers, and eloquent politicians. War is not what you see in the movies, warn Hollywood blockbusters such as Apocalypse Now, Full Metal Jacket, and Black Hawk Down. Enshrined in celluloid, prose, or poetry, the feelings of the ordinary grunt have become the ultimate authority on war, which everyone has learned to respect. As the joke goes, how many Vietnam vets does it take to change a light bulb? You wouldn't know, you weren't there. Painters, too, have lost interest in generals on horses and in tactical manoeuvres. Instead, they strive to depict how the common soldier feels. Look again at the Battle of Breitenfeld and the Battle of White Mountain. Now consider the following two pictures, considered masterpieces of 20th century war art, The War, Der Krieg, by Otto Dix, and That 2,000-Yard Stare, by Tom Lee. Dix served as a sergeant in the German army during the First World War. Lee covered the Battle of Peleliu Island in 1944 for Life magazine. Whereas Walter and Snaeus viewed war as a military and political phenomenon and wanted us to know what happened in particular battles, Dix and Lee view war as an emotional phenomenon and want us to know how it feels. They don't care about the genius of generals or about the tactical details of this or that battle. Dix's soldier might be in Verdun or Ypres or the Somme, it doesn't matter which, because war is hell everywhere. Lee's soldier just happens to be an American GI in Peleliu, but you could see exactly the same 2,000-yard stare on the face of a Japanese soldier in Iwo Jima, a German soldier in Stalingrad, or a British soldier in Dunkirk. In the paintings of Dix and Lee, the meaning of war does not emanate from tactical movements or divine proclamations. If you want to understand war, don't look up at the general on the hilltop, or at angels in the sky. Instead, looks straight into the eyes of the common soldiers. In Lee's painting, the gaping eyes of a traumatized soldier open a window onto the terrible truth of war. In Dix's painting, the truth is so unbearable that it must be partly concealed behind a gas mask. No angels fly above the battlefield, only a rotting corpse hanging from a ruined rafter and pointing an accusing finger. Artists such as Dix and Lee thus overturned the traditional hierarchy of war. In earlier times, wars could have been as horrific as in the 20th century. However, even atrocious experiences were placed within a wider context that gave them positive meaning. War might be hell, but it was also the gateway to heaven. A Catholic soldier fighting at the Battle of White Mountain could say to himself, "True, I am suffering, but the Pope and the Emperor say that we are fighting for a good cause, so my suffering is meaningful." Otto Dix employed an opposite kind of logic. He saw personal experience as the source of all meaning. Hence, his line of thinking said, "I am suffering, and this is bad, hence the whole war is bad. And if the Kaiser and the clergy nevertheless support the war, they must be mistaken." The Humanist Schism. So far, we have discussed humanism as if it were a single coherent worldview. In fact, humanism shared the fate of every successful religion, such as Christianity and Buddhism. As it spread and evolved, it fragmented into several conflicting sects. All humanist sects believe that human experience is the supreme source of authority and meaning, yet they interpret human experience in different ways. Humanism split into three main branches. The Orthodox branch holds that each human being is a unique individual, possessing a distinctive inner voice and a never-to-be-repeated string of experiences. Every human being is a singular ray of light, which illuminates the world from a different perspective, and which adds color, depth, and meaning to the universe. Hence, we ought to give as much freedom as possible to every individual to experience the world, follow his or her inner voice, and express his or her inner truth. Whether in politics, economics, or art, individual free will should have far more weight than state interests or religious doctrines. The more liberty individuals enjoy, the more beautiful, rich, and meaningful is the world. Due to this emphasis on liberty, the Orthodox branch of humanism is known as liberal humanism, or simply as liberalism. It is liberal politics that believes the voter knows best. Liberal art holds that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Liberal economics maintains that the customer is always right. Liberal ethics advises us that if it feels good, we should go ahead and do it. Liberal education teaches us to think for ourselves, because we will find all the answers within us. During the 19th and 20th centuries, as humanism gained increasing social credibility and political power, it sprouted two very different offshoots. Socialist humanism, which encompassed a plethora of socialist and communist movements, and evolutionary humanism, whose most famous advocates were the Nazis. Both offshoots agreed with liberalism that human experience is the ultimate source of meaning and authority. Neither believed in any transcendental power or divine lawbook. If, for example, you asked Karl Marx what was wrong with 10-year-olds working 12-hour shifts in smoky factories, he would have answered that it made the kids feel bad. We should avoid exploitation, oppression, and inequality, not because God said so, but because they make people miserable. However, both socialists and evolutionary humanists pointed out that the liberal understanding of the human experience is flawed. Liberals think the human experience is an individual phenomenon. But there are many individuals in the world, and they often feel different things and have contradictory desires. If all authority and meaning flows from individual experiences, how do you settle contradictions between different such experiences? On the 17th of July 2015, the German Chancellor Angela Merkel was confronted by a teenage Palestinian refugee girl from Lebanon, whose family sought asylum in Germany but faced imminent deportation. The girl, Rehm, told Merkel in fluent German that It's really very hard to watch how other people can enjoy life, and you yourself can't. I don't know what my future will bring." Merkel replied that politics can be tough, and explained that there are hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, and Germany cannot absorb them all. Stunned by this no-nonsense reply, Rehm burst out crying. Merkel proceeded to stroke the desperate girl on the back, but stuck to her guns. In the ensuing public storm, many accused Merkel of cold-hearted insensitivity. To assuage criticism, Merkel changed tack, and Rehm and her family were given asylum. In the following months, Merkel opened the door even wider, welcoming hundreds of thousands of refugees to Germany. But you can't please everybody. Soon enough she was under heavy attack for succumbing to sentimentalism and for not taking a sufficiently firm stand. Numerous German parents feared that Merkel's U-turn means their children will have a lower standard of living and perhaps suffer from a tidal wave of Islamization. Why should they risk their family's peace and prosperity for complete strangers who might not even believe in the values of liberalism? Everyone feels very strongly about this matter. How to settle the contradictions between the feelings of the desperate refugees and of the anxious Germans? Liberals forever agonize about such contradictions. The best efforts of Locke, Jefferson, Mill, and their colleagues have failed to provide us with a fast and easy solution to such conundrums. Holding democratic elections won't help, because then the question will be who would get to vote in these elections? Only German citizens? Or also millions of Asians and Africans who want to immigrate to Germany? Why privilege the feelings of one group over another? Likewise, you cannot resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict by making 8 million Israeli citizens and 350 million citizens of Arab League nations vote on it. For obvious reasons, the Israelis won't feel committed to the outcome of such a plebiscite. People feel bound by democratic elections only when they share a basic bond with most other voters. If the experience of other voters is alien to me, and if I believe they don't understand my feelings and don't care about my vital interests, then even if I am outvoted by 100-1, I have absolutely no reason to accept the verdict. Democratic elections usually work only within populations that have some prior common bond, such as shared religious beliefs and national myths. They are a method to settle disagreements between people who already agree on the basics. Accordingly, in many cases, liberalism has fused with age-old collective identities and tribal feelings to form modern nationalism. Today, many associate nationalism with anti-liberal forces, but at least during the 19th century, nationalism was closely aligned with liberalism. Liberals celebrate the unique experiences of individual humans. Each human has distinctive feelings, tastes, and quirks, which he or she should be free to express and explore as long as they don't hurt anyone else. Similarly, 19th century nationalists, such as Giuseppe Mazzini, celebrated the uniqueness of individual nations. They emphasized that many human experiences are communal. You cannot dance the polka by yourself, and you cannot invent and preserve the German language by yourself. Using word, dance, food, and drink, each nation fosters different experiences in its members and develops its own peculiar sensitivities. Liberal nationalists, like Mazzini, sought to protect these distinctive national experiences from being oppressed and obliterated by intolerant empires, and envisaged a peaceful community of nations, each free to express and explore its communal feelings without hurting its neighbors. This is still the official ideology of the European Union, whose constitution of 2004 states that Europe is united in diversity, and that the different peoples of Europe remain proud of their own national identities. The value of preserving the unique communal experiences of the German nation enables even liberal Germans to oppose opening the floodgates of immigration. Of course, the alliance with nationalism hardly solved all conundrums, while it created a host of new problems. How do you compare the value of communal experiences with that of individual experiences? Does preserving polka, bratwurst, and the German language justify leaving millions of refugees exposed to poverty and even death? And what happens when fundamental conflicts erupt within nations about the very definition of their identity, as happened in Germany in 1933, in the USA in 1861, in Spain in 1936, or in Egypt in 2011? In such cases, holding democratic elections is hardly a cure-all, because the opposing parties have no reason to respect the results. Lastly, as you dance the nationalist polka, a small but momentous step may take you from believing that your nation is different from all other nations to believing that your nation is better. 19th-century liberal nationalism required the Habsburg and Tsarist empires to respect the unique experiences of Germans, Italians, Poles, and Slovenes. 20th-century ultranationalism proceeded to wage wars of conquest and build concentration camps for people who dance to a different tune. Socialist humanism has taken a very different course. Socialists blame liberals for focusing our attention on our feelings instead of what other people experience. Yes, the human experience is the source of all meaning, but there are billions of people in the world, and all of them are just as valuable as I am. Whereas liberalism turns my gaze inwards, emphasizing my uniqueness and the uniqueness of my nation, socialism demands that I stop obsessing about me and my feelings, and instead focus on what others are feeling and about how my actions influence their experiences. Global peace will be achieved not by celebrating the distinctiveness of each nation, but by unifying all the workers of the world. And social harmony won't be achieved by each person narcissistically exploring their own inner depths, but rather by each person prioritizing the needs and experiences of others over their own desires. A liberal may reply that by exploring her own inner world, she develops her compassion and her understanding of others, but such reasoning would have cut little ice with Lenin or Mao. They would have explained that individual self-exploration is a bourgeois indulgent vice, and that when I try to get in touch with my inner self, I'm all too likely to fall into one or another capitalist trap. My current political views, my likes and dislikes, and my hobbies and ambitions do not reflect my authentic self. Rather, they reflect my upbringing and social surrounding. They depend on my class and are shaped by my neighborhood and my school. Rich and poor alike are brainwashed from birth. The rich are taught to disregard the poor, while the poor are taught to disregard their true interests. No amount of self-reflection or psychotherapy will help, because the psychotherapists are also working for the capitalist system. Indeed, self-reflection is likely only to distance me even further from understanding the truth about myself, because it gives too much credit to personal decisions and too little credit to social conditions. If I am rich, I am likely to conclude that it is because I made wise choices. If I suffer from poverty, I must have made some mistakes. If I am depressed, a liberal therapist is likely to blame my parents and to encourage me to set some new aims in life. If I suggest that perhaps I am depressed because I am being exploited by capitalists and because, under the prevailing social system, I have no chance of realizing my aims, the therapist may well say that I am projecting onto the social system my own inner difficulties, and I am projecting onto the capitalists unresolved issues with my mother. According to socialism, instead of spending years talking about my mother, my emotions, and my complexes, I should ask myself, who owns the means of production in my country? What are its main exports and imports? What's the connection between the ruling politicians and international banking? Only by understanding the surrounding socio-economic system and taking into account the experiences of all other people could I truly understand what I feel, and only by common action can we change the system. Yet what person can take into account the experiences of all human beings and weigh them one against the other in a fair way? That's why socialists discourage self-exploration and advocate the establishment of strong collective institutions, such as socialist parties and trade unions, that aim to decipher the world for us. Whereas in liberal politics the voter knows best, and in liberal economics, the customer is always right. In socialist politics, the party knows best, and in socialist economics, the trade union is always right. Authority and meaning still come from human experience. Both the party and the trade union are composed of people and work to alleviate human misery. Yet individuals must listen to the party and the trade union rather than to their personal feelings. Evolutionary humanism has a different solution to the problem of conflicting human experiences. Rooting itself in the firm ground of Darwinian evolutionary theory, it says that conflict is something to applaud rather than lament. Conflict is the raw material of natural selection, which pushes evolution forward. Some humans are simply superior to others, and when human experiences collide, the fittest humans should steamroll everyone else. The same logic that drives humankind to exterminate wild wolves and to ruthlessly exploit domesticated sheep also mandates the oppression of inferior humans by their superiors. It's a good thing that Europeans conquer Africans and that shrewd businessmen drive the dim-witted to bankruptcy. If we follow this evolutionary logic, humankind will gradually become stronger and fitter, eventually giving rise to superhumans. Evolution didn't stop with Homo sapiens. There is still a long way to go. However, if in the name of human rights or human equality, we emasculate the fittest humans, it will prevent the rise of the Superman, and may even cause the degeneration and extinction of Homo sapiens. Who exactly are these superior humans who herald the coming of the Superman? They might be entire races, particular tribes, or exceptional individual geniuses. In any case, what makes them superior is that they have better abilities, manifested in the creation of new knowledge, more advanced technology, more prosperous societies, or more beautiful art. The experience of an Einstein or a Beethoven is far more valuable than that of a drunken good-for-nothing, and it is ludicrous to treat them as if they have equal merit. Similarly, if a particular nation has consistently spearheaded human progress, we should rightly consider it superior to other nations that have contributed little or nothing to the evolution of humankind. Consequently, in contrast to liberal artists like Otto Dix, evolutionary humanism thinks that the human experience of war is valuable and even essential. The movie The Third Man takes place in Vienna immediately after the end of the Second World War. Reflecting on the recent conflict, the character Harry Lime says, "After all, it's not that awful. In Italy, for 30 years under the Borgias, they had warfare, terror, murder, and bloodshed, but they produced Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, and the Renaissance. In Switzerland, they had brotherly love, they had 500 years of democracy and peace, and what did that produce? The cuckoo clock." Lime gets almost all his facts wrong. Switzerland was probably the most bloodthirsty corner of early modern Europe. Its main export was mercenary soldiers, and the cuckoo clock was actually invented by the Germans. But the facts are of lesser importance than Lime's idea, namely that the experience of war pushes humankind to new achievements. War allows natural selection free rein at last. It exterminates the weak and rewards the fierce and the ambitious. War exposes the truth about life and awakens the will for power, for glory, and for conquest. Nietzsche summed it up by saying that war is the school of life, and that what does not kill me makes me stronger. Similar ideas were expressed by Lieutenant Henry Jones of the British Army. 3 days before his death on the Western Front in the First World War, the 21-year-old Jones sent a letter to his brother, describing the experience of war in glowing terms. "Have you ever reflected on the fact that, despite the horrors of war, it is at least a big thing? I mean to say that in it one is brought face to face with realities. The follies, selfishness, luxury, and general pettiness of the vile commercial sort of existence, led by 9/10 of the people of the world in peacetime, are replaced in war by a savagery that is at least more honest and outspoken. Look at it this way. In peacetime one just lives one's own little life, engaged in trivialities, worrying about one's own comfort, about money matters, and all that sort of thing. Just living for one's own self. What a sordid life it is. In war, on the other hand, even if you do get killed, you only anticipate the inevitable by a few years in any case, and you have the satisfaction of knowing that you have pegged out in the attempt to help your country. You have, in fact, realized an ideal, which, as far as I can see, you very rarely do in ordinary life. The reason is that ordinary life runs on a commercial and selfish basis. If you want to get on, as the saying is, you can't keep your hands clean. Personally, I often rejoice that the war has come my way. It has made me realize what a petty thing life is. I think that the war has given to everyone a chance to get out of himself, as I might say. Certainly, speaking for myself, I can say that I have never in all my life experienced such a wild exhilaration as on the commencement of a big stunt, like the last April one, for example. The excitement for the last half hour or so before it is like nothing on earth. In his bestseller, Black Hawk Down, the journalist Mark Bowden relates in similar terms the combat experience of Sean Nelson, an American soldier, in Mogadishu in 1993. It was hard to describe how he felt. It was like an epiphany. Close to death, he had never felt so completely alive. There had been split seconds in his life when he'd felt death brush past, like when another fast-moving car veered from around a sharp curve and just missed hitting him head-on. On this day he had lived with that feeling, with death breathing right in his face, for moment after moment after moment, for 3 hours or more. Combat was a state of complete mental and physical awareness. In those hours on the street he had not been Sean Nelson. He had no connection to the larger world, no bills to pay, no emotional ties, nothing. He had just been a human being staying alive from one nanosecond to the next, drawing one breath after another, fully aware that each one might be his last. He felt he would never be the same. Adolf Hitler, too, was changed and enlightened by his war experiences. In Mein Kampf, he tells how shortly after his unit reached the front line, the soldiers' initial enthusiasm turned into fear, against which each soldier had to wage a relentless inner war, straining every nerve to avoid being overwhelmed by it. Hitler says that he won this inner war by the winter of 1915-16. "At last," he writes, "my will was undisputed master. I was now calm and determined, and this was enduring. Now fate could bring on the ultimate tests without my nerves shattering or my reason failing." The experience of war revealed to Hitler the truth about the world. It is a jungle run by the remorseless laws of natural selection. Those who refuse to recognize this truth cannot survive. If you wish to succeed, you must not only understand the laws of the jungle, but embrace them joyfully. It should be stressed that, just like the anti-war liberal artists, Hitler too sanctified the experience of ordinary soldiers. Indeed, Hitler's political career is one of the best examples we have for the immense authority accorded to the personal experience of common people in 20th century politics. Hitler wasn't a senior officer. In 4 years of war, he rose no higher than the rank of corporal. He had no formal education, no professional skills, and no political background. He wasn't a successful businessman or a union activist. He didn't have friends or relatives in high places or any money to speak of. At first, he didn't even have German citizenship. He was a penniless immigrant. When Hitler appealed to the German voters and asked for their trust, he could muster only one argument in his favor. His experiences in the trenches had taught him what you can never learn at university, at general headquarters, or at a government ministry. People followed him and voted for him because they identified with him, and because they too believed that the world is a jungle, and that what doesn't kill us only makes us stronger. Whereas liberalism merged with the milder versions of nationalism to protect the unique experiences of each human community, evolutionary humanists such as Hitler identified particular nations as the engines of human progress, and concluded that these nations ought to bludgeon or even exterminate anyone standing in their way. It should be remembered, though, that Hitler and the Nazis represent only one extreme version of evolutionary humanism. just as Stalin's gulags do not automatically nullify every socialist idea and argument, so too the horrors of Nazism should not blind us to whatever insights evolutionary humanism might offer. Nazism was born from the pairing of evolutionary humanism with particular racial theories and ultra-nationalist emotions. Not all evolutionary humanists are racists, and not every belief in humankind's potential for further evolution necessarily calls for setting up police states and concentration camps. Auschwitz should serve as a blood-red warning sign rather than as a black curtain that hides entire sections of the human horizon. Evolutionary humanism played an important part in the shaping of modern culture, and it is likely to play an even greater role in the shaping of the 21st century. Is Beethoven better than Chuck Berry? To make sure we understand the difference between the three humanist branches, let's compare a few human experiences. Experience number one. A musicology professor sits in the Vienna Opera House, listening to the opening of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Pa-pa-pa-pam. As the sound waves hit his eardrums, signals travel via the auditory nerve to the brain, and the adrenal gland floods his bloodstream with adrenaline. His heartbeat accelerates, his breathing intensifies, the hairs on his neck stand up, and a shiver runs down his spine. Pa-pa-pa-pam. Experience number two. It's 1965. A Mustang convertible is speeding down the Pacific Road from San Francisco to L.A. at full throttle. The young macho driver puts on Chuck Berry at full volume. Go, go, Johnny, go, go! As the sound waves hit his eardrums, signals travel via the auditory nerve to the brain, and the adrenal gland floods his bloodstream with adrenaline. His heartbeat accelerates, his breathing intensifies, the hairs on his neck stand up, and a shiver runs down his spine. Go, go, Johnny, go, go. Experience number three. Deep in the Congolese rainforest, a pygmy hunter stands transfixed. From the nearby village, he hears a choir of girls singing their initiation song. Yeo-o, yeo-e. As the sound waves hit his eardrums, signals travel via the auditory nerve to the brain, and the adrenal gland floods his bloodstream with adrenaline. His heartbeat accelerates. His breathing intensifies, the hairs on his neck stand up, and a shiver runs down his spine. Yeo-o, yeo-e. Experience number four. It's a full moon night, somewhere in the Canadian Rockies. A wolf is standing on a hilltop, listening to the howls of a female in heat. Au! Au! As the sound waves hit his eardrums, signals travel via the auditory nerve to the brain, and the adrenal gland floods his bloodstream with adrenaline. His heartbeat accelerates, his breathing intensifies, the hairs on his neck stand up, and a shiver runs down his spine. Au! Au! Which of these four experiences is the most valuable? If you are liberal, you will tend to say that the experiences of the musicology professor, of the young driver, and of the Congolese hunter are all equally valuable, and all should be equally cherished. Every human experience contributes something unique and enriches the world with new meaning. Some people like classical music, others love rock and roll, and still others prefer traditional African chants. Music students should be exposed to the widest possible range of genres, and at the end of the day, everyone could go to the iTunes store, punch in their credit card number, and buy what they like. Beauty is in the ears of the listener, and the customer is always right. The wolf, though, isn't human, hence his experiences are far less valuable. That's why the life of a wolf is worth less than the life of a human, and why it is perfectly okay to kill a wolf in order to save a human. When all is said and done, wolves don't get to vote in any beauty contests, nor do they hold any credit cards. This liberal approach is manifested, for example, in the Voyager Golden Record. In 1977, the Americans launched the space probe Voyager 1 on a journey to outer space. By now it has left the solar system, making it the first man-made object to traverse interstellar space. Besides state-of-the-art scientific equipment, NASA placed on board a golden record, aimed to introduce planet Earth to any inquisitive aliens who might encounter the probe. The record contains a variety of scientific and cultural information about Earth and its inhabitants, some images and voices, and several dozen pieces of music from around the world, which are supposed to represent a fair sample of earthly artistic achievement. The musical sample mixes in no obvious order classical pieces, including the opening movement of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, contemporary popular music, including Chuck Berry's Johnny B. Goode, and traditional music from throughout the world, including an initiation song of Congolese pygmy girls. Though the record also contains some canine howls, they are not part of the music sample, but rather relegated to a different section that also includes the sounds of wind, rain, and surf. The message to potential listeners in Alpha Centauri is that Beethoven, Chuck Berry, and the Pygmy Initiation Song are of equal merit, whereas wolf howls belong to an altogether different category. If you are socialist, you will probably agree with the liberals that the wolf's experience is of little value. But your attitude towards the three human experiences will be quite different. A socialist true believer will explain that the real value of music depends not on the experiences of the individual listener, but on the impact it has on the experiences of other people and of society as a whole. As Mao said, there is no such thing as art for art's sake, art that stands above classes, art that is detached from or independent of politics. So when coming to evaluate the musical experiences, a socialist will focus, for example, on the fact that Beethoven wrote the Fifth Symphony for an audience of upper-class white Europeans, exactly when Europe was about to embark on its conquest of Africa. His symphony reflected Enlightenment ideals, which glorified upper-class white men and branded the conquest of Africa as the white man's burden. Rock and roll, the socialists will say, was pioneered by downtrodden African-American musicians who drew inspiration from genres like blues, jazz, and gospel. However, in the 1950s and 1960s, rock and roll was hijacked by mainstream white America and pressed into the service of consumerism, of American imperialism, and of coca-colonization. Rock and roll was commercialized and appropriated by privileged white teenagers in their petit bourgeois fantasy of rebellion. Chuck Berry himself bowed to the dictates of the capitalist juggernaut. While he originally sang about a colored boy named Johnny B. Goode, under pressure from white-owned radio stations, Berry changed the lyrics to a country boy named Johnny B. Goode. As for the choir of Congolese pygmy girls, their initiation songs are part of a patriarchal power structure that brainwashes both men and women to conform to an oppressive gender order. And if a recording of such an initiation song ever makes it to the global marketplace, it merely serves to reinforce Western colonial fantasies about Africa in general and about African women in particular. So, which music is best? Beethoven's Fifth, Johnny B. Goode, or the Pygmy Initiation Song? Should the government finance the building of opera houses, rock and roll venues, or African heritage exhibitions? And what should we teach music students in schools and colleges? Well, don't ask me. Ask the party's cultural commissar. Whereas liberals tiptoe around the minefield of cultural comparisons, fearful of committing some politically incorrect faux pas, and whereas socialists leave it to the party to find the right path through the minefield, evolutionary humanists gleefully jump right in, setting off all the mines and relishing the mayhem. They may start by pointing out that both liberals and socialists draw the line at other animals, and have no trouble admitting that humans are superior to wolves, and that consequently human music is far more valuable than wolf howls. Yet humankind itself is not exempt from the forces of evolution. Just as humans are superior to wolves, so some human cultures are more advanced than others. There is an unambiguous hierarchy of human experiences, and we shouldn't be apologetic about it. The Taj Mahal is more beautiful than a straw hut. Michelangelo's David is superior to my 5-year-old niece's latest clay figurine, and Beethoven composed far better music than Chuck Berry or the Congolese pygmies. There, we've said it. According to evolutionary humanists, anyone arguing that all human experiences are equally valuable is either an imbecile or a coward. Such vulgarity and timidity will lead only to the degeneration and extinction of humankind, as human progress is impeded in the name of cultural relativism or social equality. If liberals or socialists had lived in the Stone Age, they would probably have seen little merit in the murals of Lascaux and Altamira, and would have insisted that they are in no way superior to Neanderthal doodles. The Humanist Wars of Religion. Initially, the differences between liberal humanism, socialist humanism, and evolutionary humanism seemed rather frivolous. Set against the enormous gap separating all humanist sects from Christianity, Islam, or Hinduism, the arguments between different versions of humanism were trifling. As long as we all agree that God is dead, and that only the human experience gives meaning to the universe, does it really matter whether we think that all human experiences are equal, or that some are superior to others? Yet as humanism conquered the world, these internal schisms widened, and eventually flared up into the deadliest war of religion in history. In the first decade of the 20th century, the liberal orthodoxy was still confident of its strength. Liberals were convinced that if we only gave individuals maximum freedom to express themselves and follow their hearts, the world would enjoy unprecedented peace and prosperity. It may take time to completely dismantle the fetters of traditional hierarchies, obscurantist religions, and brutal empires, but every decade would bring new liberties and achievements, and eventually we would create paradise on earth. In the halcyon days of June 1914, liberals thought history was on their side. By Christmas 1914, liberals were shell-shocked, and in the following decades their ideas were subjected to a double assault from both left and right. Socialists argued that liberalism is in fact a fig leaf for a ruthless, exploitative, and racist system. For vaunted liberty, read property. The defense of the individual's right to do what feels good amounts in most cases to safeguarding the property and privileges of the middle and upper classes. What good is the liberty to live where you want when you cannot pay the rent, to study what interests you when you cannot afford the tuition fees, and to travel where you fancy when you cannot buy a car? Under liberalism went a famous quip, "Everyone is free to starve." Even worse, by encouraging people to view themselves as isolated individuals, liberalism separates them from their other class members and prevents them from uniting against the system that oppresses them. Liberalism thereby perpetuates inequality, condemning the masses to poverty and the elite to alienation. While liberalism staggered under this left punch, evolutionary humanism struck from the right. Racists and fascists blamed both liberalism and socialism for subverting natural selection and causing the degeneration of humankind. They warned that if all humans were given equal value and equal breeding opportunities, natural selection would cease to function. The fittest humans would be submerged in an ocean of mediocrity, and instead of evolving into Superman, humankind would become extinct. From 1914 to 1989, a murderous war of religion raged between the three humanist sects, and liberalism at first sustained one defeat after the other. Not only did communist and fascist regimes take over numerous countries, but the core liberal ideas were exposed as naive at best, if not downright dangerous. Just give freedom to individuals and the world will enjoy peace and prosperity? Yeah, right. The Second World War, which, with hindsight, we remember as a great liberal victory, hardly looked like that at the time. The war began as a conflict between a mighty liberal alliance and an isolated Nazi Germany. Until June 1940, even fascist Italy preferred to play a waiting game. The liberal alliance enjoyed overwhelming numerical and economic superiority. While German GDP in 1940 stood at $387 million, the GDP of Germany's European opponents totaled $631 million, not including the GDP of the overseas British dominions and of the British, French, Dutch, and Belgian empires. Still, in the spring of 1940, It took Germany a mere 3 months to deal the Liberal Alliance a decisive blow and occupy France, the Low Countries, Norway, and Denmark. The UK was saved from a similar fate only by the English Channel. The Germans were eventually beaten only when the Liberal countries allied themselves with the Soviet Union, which bore the brunt of the conflict and paid a much higher price. 25 million Soviet citizens died in the war, compared to 500,000 Britons and 500,000 Americans. Much of the credit for defeating Nazism should be given to communism. And, at least in the short term, communism was also the great beneficiary of the war. The Soviet Union entered the war as an isolated communist pariah. It emerged as one of the two global superpowers and the leader of an expanding international bloc. By 1949, Eastern Europe became a Soviet satellite. The Chinese Communist Party won the Chinese Civil War, and the United States was gripped by anti-communist hysteria. Revolutionary and anti-colonial movements throughout the world looked longingly towards Moscow and Beijing, while liberalism became identified with the racist European empires. As these empires collapsed, they were usually replaced by either military dictatorships or socialist regimes, not liberal democracies. In 1956, the Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev confidently told the liberal West that, "Whether you like it or not, history is on our side. We will bury you." Khrushchev sincerely believed this, as did increasing numbers of Third World leaders and First World intellectuals. In the 1960s and 1970s, the word liberal became a term of abuse in many Western universities. North America and Western Europe experienced growing social unrest as radical left-wing movements strove to undermine the liberal order. Students in Paris, London, Rome, and the People's Republic of Berkeley thumbed through Chairman Mao's little red book and hung Che Guevara's heroic portrait over their beds. In 1968, the wave crested with the outbreak of protests and riots all over the Western world. Mexican security forces killed dozens of students in the notorious Tlatelolco massacre. Students in Rome fought the Italian police in the so-called Battle of Valle Giulia, and the assassination of Martin Luther King sparked days of riots and protests in more than 100 American cities. In May, students took over the streets of Paris. President de Gaulle fled to a French military base in Germany, and well-to-do French citizens trembled in their beds, having guillotine nightmares. By 1970, the world contained 130 independent countries, but only 30 of these were liberal democracies, most of which were crammed into the northwestern corner of Europe. India was the only important Third World country that committed to the liberal path after securing its independence, but even India distanced itself from the Western bloc and leaned towards the Soviets. In 1975, the liberal camp suffered its most humiliating defeat of all. The Vietnam War ended with the North Vietnamese David overcoming the American Goliath. In quick succession, communism took over South Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. On the 17th of April 1975, the Cambodian capital, Phnom Penh, fell to the Khmer Rouge. 2 weeks later, people all over the world watched as helicopters evacuated the last Yankees from the rooftop of the American embassy in Saigon. Many were certain that the American empire was falling. Before anyone could say domino theory, on the 25th of June, Indira Gandhi proclaimed the emergency in India, and it seemed that the world's largest democracy was on its way to becoming yet another socialist dictatorship. Liberal democracy increasingly looked like an exclusive club for aging white imperialists who had little to offer the rest of the world, or even their own youth. Washington presented itself as the leader of the free world, but most of its allies were either authoritarian kings, such as King Khaled of Saudi Arabia, King Hassan of Morocco, and the Persian Shah, or military dictators, such as the Greek colonels, General Pinochet in Chile, General Franco in Spain, General Park in South Korea, General Gyesu in Brazil, and Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek in Taiwan. Despite the support of all these colonels and generals, militarily the Warsaw Pact had a huge numerical superiority over NATO. In order to reach parity in conventional armament, Western countries would probably have had to scrap liberal democracy and the free market and become totalitarian states on a permanent war footing. Liberal democracy was saved only by nuclear weapons. NATO adopted the doctrine of MAD, mutual assured destruction, according to which even conventional Soviet attacks would be answered by an all-out nuclear strike. "If you attack us," threatened the liberals, "we will make sure nobody comes out of it alive." Behind this monstrous shield, liberal democracy and the free market managed to hold out in their last bastions, and Westerners could enjoy sex, drugs, and rock and roll, as well as washing machines, refrigerators, and televisions. Without nukes, there would have been no Woodstock, no Beatles, and no overflowing supermarkets. But in the mid-1970s, it seemed that, nuclear weapons notwithstanding, the future belonged to socialism. And then everything changed. Liberal democracy crawled out of history's dustbin, cleaned itself up, and conquered the world. The supermarket proved to be far stronger than the gulag. The Blitzkrieg began in southern Europe, where the authoritarian regimes in Greece, Spain, and Portugal collapsed, giving way to democratic governments. In 1977, Indira Gandhi ended the emergency, re-establishing democracy in India. During the 1980s, military dictatorships in East Asia and Latin America were replaced by democratic governments in countries such as Brazil, Argentina, Taiwan, and South Korea. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, the liberal wave turned into a veritable tsunami, sweeping away the mighty Soviet Empire and raising expectations of the coming end of history. After decades of defeats and setbacks, liberalism won a decisive victory in the Cold War, emerging triumphant from the humanist wars of religion, albeit a bit worse for wear. As the Soviet Empire imploded, liberal democracies replaced communist regimes not only in Eastern Europe, but also in many of the former Soviet republics, such as the Baltic states, Ukraine, Georgia, and Armenia. Even Russia nowadays pretends to be a democracy. Victory in the Cold War gave renewed impetus for the spread of the liberal model elsewhere around the world, most notably in Latin America, South Asia, and Africa. Some liberal experiments ended in abject failures, but the number of success stories is impressive. For instance, Indonesia, Nigeria, and Chile have been ruled by military strongmen for decades, but all are now functioning democracies. If a liberal had fallen asleep in June 1914 and woken up in June 2014, he or she would have felt very much at home. Once again, people believe that if you just give individuals more freedom, the world will enjoy peace and prosperity. The entire 20th century looks like a big mistake. Humankind was speeding on the liberal highway back in the summer of 1914 when it took a wrong turn and entered a cul-de-sac. It then needed 8 decades and 3 horrendous global wars to find its way back to the highway. Of course, these decades were not a total waste, as they did give us antibiotics, nuclear energy, and computers, as well as feminism, decolonialism, and free sex. In addition, liberalism itself smarted from the experience and is less conceited than it was a century ago. It has adopted various ideas and institutions from its socialist and fascist rivals, in particular a commitment to provide the general public with education, health, and welfare services. Yet the core liberal package has changed surprisingly little. Liberalism still sanctifies individual liberties above all, and still has a firm belief in the voter and the customer. In the early 21st century, this is the only show in town. Electricity, genetics, and radical Islam. As of 2016, there is no serious alternative to the liberal package of individualism, human rights, democracy, and a free market. The social protests that swept the Western world in 2011, such as Occupy Wall Street and the Spanish 15M movement, have absolutely nothing against democracy, individualism, and human rights, or even against the basic principles of free market economics. Just the opposite. They take governments to task for not living up to these liberal ideals. They demand that the market be really free, instead of being controlled and manipulated by corporations and banks too big to fail. They call for truly representative democratic institutions, which will serve the interests of ordinary citizens rather than of moneyed lobbyists and powerful interest groups. Even those blasting stock